I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday, and it's midday. The midday news wrap. It's been a dizzying first week for the Trump administration. The president has wasted little time moving to restrict immigration, repeal the Affordable Care Act, and build a border wall. Mr. Trump and Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto called off a meeting after trading barbs on Twitter. Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, is meeting with the president at this hour. Perhaps Mr. Trump will tell her that his inauguration crowd was the biggest ever. He seems to tell everybody else. It's not true, but truthiness has taken on a whole new meaning in the last 7 days. New Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh is wrestling with the city's rising homicide rate. Governor Hogan is wrestling with severe structural deficits. We'll wrestle with what it all means. Professor Kimberly Moffitt of UMBC, Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun, and businessman James DeGraffenwright join me for the Midday News Wrap right after these headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us on this Friday afternoon. It's the Midday News Wrap. Today marks the end of the first week of the Trump administration, a week marked by a dizzying array of executive actions and pronouncements by the president that at times placed him in opposition to his senior team. Trump showed no inclination to change his tone or style during or following his inauguration, nor did he show an impulse to modify any positions in the face of clear evidence that he is mistaken. He held a lot of meetings, including with union leaders, perhaps forging an unlikely alliance with organized labor. His meeting with the president of Mexico has been canceled. His determination to build his beloved wall is undeterred. He put the Dakota Access Pipeline back in play. He promised to get rid of 75% of federal regulations. He insisted that his inauguration crowd was the largest ever. It wasn't. He reasserted his description of journalists as among the most dishonest human beings on the face of the earth. And on his second day in office, some 3 million people demonstrated in cities around the globe. We'll start today's Midday News Wrap with a look back at week one of the Trump era. Andy Green is the editorial page editor for the Baltimore Sun. James DeGraffenwright is a former chair of the Maryland State Board of Education, a businessman who sits on several corporate boards, and a lawyer. Kimberly Moffitt is a media critic and associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Welcome to you all. It's good to see you.
Hi, Tom.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So, Kimberly, let me start with you. Some folks look at this week.
Ladies first,
I guess. I don't know. But some folks look at this week and they say this is an administration that's in disarray. They're just, you know, all over the place. They're saying stuff. They're retracting it. They're saying stuff that people in their senior teams are disavowing. Others look at it and say, this is what we voted for. This is a week that they are getting down to business. He's not wasting any time. He's signing all sorts of things that indicate his willingness to do exactly what he said when he was elected president. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how divided the nation is, that we are seeing it on both sides where, I mean, even on, you know, other NPR programming, it's clear through the programs that are talking to Trump voters that he's on task. He's doing exactly what it is that we desire as a nation to see, or at least what some believe us to see. I tend to lean towards the other side, where I think things do feel like they are unwilled or in disarray and not as smooth a transition as I would have expected from president to president. And I think that based on especially some of the attention that the current president is placing on things that are outside of the purview or should be outside of the purview of what is important for the nation right now, that's the part that concerns me the most.
And James DeGraffenwright, when it comes to, for example, his list of nominees for various cabinet positions, let's talk about one in particular, Betsy DeVos, who's been nominated to be the Secretary of Education. The Education Committee has decided to delay a vote on her nomination until Tuesday. They were going to vote last Tuesday. Reasons for that somewhat unclear. Lamar Alexander from Tennessee chairs that committee. Education is something that you've spent a lot of time on. Using her as an example, and she may be the one of all the nominees that may be in the most trouble. Some people say that, you know, that may be one that doesn't get through. What does that say to you about where this administration is heading?
Well, I think that the DeVos nomination crystallizes a debate about what is public education supposed to be about. And like I said, I'm not a political consultant, never have been one, but I can count.
And I apologize for referring to you as that in a promo for this broadcast.
But I think,
you've not been paid to go tell people how to win elections.
But I think we can all count, right? And the Senate, which has to confirm, has the clear majority, and the Democrats sort of blew themselves up when they went with the so-called nuclear option by saying you can't filibuster except in a rare, you know, like a Supreme Court nomination, for example. So they don't need 60 votes. They only need 51, and they start out with 52, right? You know, so they're not even going to need the tiebreaker. But DeVos is controversial with some folks because she has spent her entire career and a lot of money. She's one of the billionaires club, supporting everything but public education. She likes charter schools. She likes vouchers. And without offering a view one way or the other about good or bad, you begin at the beginning as what is society's objective in having public schools, and do we have unlimited resources or not? You pull the string at one end to fund charter schools or vouchers. It gets shorter at the other for traditional public schools. So the question you got to ask is, what is society's objective and what's the most efficient way to deliver on that objective? And for example, in the state of Maryland, our state constitution commits to giving all students a free and fair public education. Maryland has been committed to excellence in education. And the question is, what's the most efficient way to deliver on that promise? I'm a former utility executive, so I understand that society made a choice that we're not going to have five different companies running wires down the street to deliver electricity or telecommunications or pipes down the street to deliver natural gas because society is paying for it. Scale matters. And if you regulate it appropriately, you're going to replicate the benefits of competition and so on. So the question is, for education, it's the same thing. Do you have sufficient scale to support these various alternatives outside of the traditional public school system or not? If the answer is we can do both, then you got to answer the resource question first before you take a position about are you for or against this or that alternative.
And Andy Green, people point to Ms. DeVos as a person who's never worked in a public mm-hmm. school, never run a public school system, and never went to a public school as a child.
Right.
And this nominee process brings up this notion of what are the criteria for qualification
right, well,
for any of these
it's
jobs?
It's not only that. It's that in her confirmation hearing, she showed a complete lack of familiarity with even the basic terms of education policy, was not familiar with huge swaths of what the Department of Education does, you know, ranging from, dealing with rape on college campuses to the terms used to describe standardized test performance. So I think that's where she has really come to be, perhaps, as you say, the most troubled of the nominees.
There are other nominees. I think of Ben Carson, for example, nominated to run HUD. There are lots of people who say—
He has lived in housing.
Right. He has lived in a house. But
actually, he denies that. He says, I was poor. But I think he corrected his bio to say that he never lived in public housing.
Yeah. But one of the things that people say about him is that he's not qualified to run a federal agency because he's never done it before. And one of the people who said that was him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, but doesn't this come down to the president was elected and he gets to choose? So whether or not Ms. DeVos or Dr. Carson are qualified, in a sense, doesn't matter because we're not electing them. We're electing Mr. Trump to decide who should run these programs.
Well, and certainly in the case of Betsy DeVos and support for vouchers, for example, President Trump was talking during the campaign of funneling $20 billion to the states to set up voucher programs, and where that money was going to come from, I don't know, but I suspect from support for traditional public schools. Likewise with the housing department, it's not like Ben Carson is the one out there setting the administration's policy. You know, it's the president is setting that direction. And so whether we get him or someone else, doesn't matter in that sense. It may matter in the sense of who is actually a good manager for these agencies. I mean, you know, HUD is an enormous agency. And as we've seen here in Baltimore, if you don't manage public housing well, you have all kinds of problems. You know, the cases that we had over the last few years of massive maintenance problems and people not getting them fixed and then actual horrible scandals related to that. So the management does matter, too. You know, generally, that's not something that the Senate is going to reject someone for, but may, in fact, be the most important thing.
But I do think it just to add to that point, that this is the only system of checks and balances that we have in our nation. And so Congress becomes the voice of the people, supposedly. So even though our president has nominated someone and saying, this is who I want to serve in this capacity, it is through the voice, our voice, through the Congress that gives us the opportunity to kind of push back and say, yes, but. And unfortunately, based on the Congress we do have in place now and the fact that it is Republican controlled, that checks and balances does seem a little more murky.
I mean, we do have examples like Rex Tillerson, James DeGraffenreid, you know, Marco Rubio seemed to draw a lot of attention to himself being putatively oppositional to the president, a person who called him Little Marco on the campaign trail for months at a time. And then at the end, he voted for Rex Tillerson, and it looks like that nomination will succeed. But of course, people who are reading tea leaves in Washington these days, tea leaf reading is a much more complicated endeavor than it ever used to be, perhaps, because Washington Post reporting, for example, and others reporting that the entire senior staff of the State Department has resigned. So does that mean they're resigning in opposition to Tillerson or in opposition to Trump? Or is it just that they're, you know, decided to, you know, end their careers at this particular moment? Is it coincidental? What do you read into that?
The president gets to pick his team, and I don't read anything beyond that. I agree that the confirmation process is part of the checks and balances and an important step, but history shows us that it is the rare exception for a cabinet nominee to be declined the confirmation of a Senate than not, whether there is a supermajority of one party or the other opposing the president or not. President gets his team, and we saw that in the Obama administration when it came to cabinet appointments. Even when the Republicans had a majority of the Senate, he got his appointments, even though they grilled them and gave him a hard time. That's just normal. It seems to me part of the American process. The more significant opportunity to push back from a policy perspective occurs in regulations in the courts. So, for example, Department of Education, HUD, you were mentioning, I think everybody should be troubled, frankly, with Governor Perry and Department of Energy Secretary, and he had no idea that the lion's share of that business had to do with the nuclear energy industry and our—
And the nuclear arsenal.
And spent fuel and the nuclear arsenal. He had no idea that that was the job. Mm-hmm. Be that as it may, the professionals in those agencies do know their jobs, the career people. And the people who have resigned were not necessarily career. They spent their careers there, but they were at the political appointee level where they were at-will employees.
And so you're seeing a lot of signs that the bureaucracy is not going quietly into the night here. You know, the flashiest example is, of course, the guy out in Badlands National Park.
With the National Park Service.
Tweeting out.
Coming up with Twitter handles.
Coming out with facts about climate change, I think basically on the grounds of, okay, Mr. President, if you can find me in South Dakota, go ahead and fire me. But and so you're seeing a lot more of this. You know, there a lot of leaks coming out of the government in various places, reports of people kind of backing up data on the side so to prevent it from being manipulated or destroyed. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And you see the Times and the Post are setting up secure portals for people to slip them documents. And apparently a lot of people are doing that. So,
and on the one level, a lot of people noticed that that 5 minutes after the oath of office was taken, the LGBTQ website came down, or web page came down, right, on the whitehouse.gov website. The
Spanish
web pages,
translation is
Spanish
gone.
Translations, stuff about women. I mean, there were some very immediate changes that clearly were in the works. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's reflective of every transition team. I mean, yeah. I that didn't stun me. And based on who we know is our current president, some of those moves made sense. Many of us may not care for them, but it seemed in line with what the current administration values and wants to support. And so he was just carrying that out like it happens between every transition.
It's the Midday News Wrap. Kimberly Moffitt is a media critic and associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Andy Green is the editorial page editor for the Baltimore Sun. James DeGraffenwright is a former chair of the Maryland State Board of Education. He's a businessman and a lawyer. You are welcome to join our conversation when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, giving a second chance to people who have been served failure to appear warrants. The crimes that they've been accused of are often minor, but the consequences of the warrant can be catastrophic. Douglas Colbert of the Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland joins us, along with Rachel Bay, WIPR's Statehouse reporter, to talk about criminal justice issues that are being addressed in this year's General Assembly, including several bills to reform the cash bail system. If you've just joined us today, it is the Midday News Wrap. I'm joined here in Studio A by James DeGraffenwright, a former chair of the Maryland State Board of Education, a businessman and a lawyer. Andy Green is the editorial page editor for the Baltimore Sun. And Kimberly Moffitt is a media critic and associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. You are welcome to join us for our conversation, looking back at what's happening in the news this past week. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And if you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. I will tell you, we're having some technical difficulties with the phones in particular. So if you have the capacity to send an email, that may be your better bet. I might be able to get to the emails a little quicker than the calls, but we will do our best as our tech is letting us down slightly. But thank you for listening, and I hope you can become involved in some way. So Andy Green, let's talk a little bit about some local news. Catherine Pugh is 3 or 4 weeks into her administration, or more than that, I guess, yeah, like 6 or 7, something like that.
Right.
She's facing what continues to be an epidemic of violence. I mean, 26 yes. shootings in the first 25 days.
26 murders in the first
murders
25
days. In the first 25 days. You know, she's learning what a lot of mayors before her have learned, that this is a very intractable and difficult problem to address.
And worse now than it has been in the recent past. You know, ever since the unrest following Freddie Gray's death, violence has been at a level we have not seen here since the 1990s. You know, Chicago gets a lot of attention. The president is saying, you know, send the troops into Chicago. If we had Chicago's homicide rate today, we would be ecstatic. You know, Chicago's homicide rate,
given the number of people they have in the city,
is something that is like an unattainable dream for Baltimore at this point. Yeah, you know, so that's to put it in a little bit of context. You know, Chief Davis has been in his post for about a year and a half now. It has not been a particularly good time in terms of driving down violent crime here. We're starting to get a lot of conversations about the size of the police force that shrank during the Rawlings-Blake administration. She eliminated some positions. She held others open for budget-saving purposes. Mayor Pugh has authorized hiring about 100 people back, but even that still would keep us at a pretty low level, historically speaking. But, you know, There are a lot of factors involved here beyond just police tactics and police numbers on the streets. There's, you know, the general breakdown in terms of community trust for the criminal justice system, prevents people from cooperating with police, prevents witnesses from coming forward. People are raising questions about how well prosecutors are bringing cases, whether they're getting convictions at the rate they need to, which contributes to a system of street justice that leads to exacerbated violence. I mean, it is a very difficult problem, but it's one that I think is only sort of now, after a year and a half of this, getting the kind of sustained attention from policymakers and the public that it really needs.
Kimberly Moffitt, we've been talking about this ever since the uprising in 2015, about what's needed to address these things. It's jobs, it's opportunity, it's education, it's better housing, it's getting rid of lead poisoning, it's addressing all of the above. But what do you say to folks who say, you know, that's all well and good, but those are long-term solutions? There are 39 reported carjackings already here in the first month. I mean, people are worried to unload groceries from their cars in certain neighborhoods. And these are not just the neighborhoods in East and West Baltimore that have long been plagued mm-hmm. by horrible violence. What do we say to folks who say, what about now? How do we stop people shooting each other and committing robberies and committing crimes right now?
And I don't know if there's a short answer to that, because I do think all of the litany of issues plaguing the city that you mentioned are exactly what have to be addressed in order for us to get to a point where we start to see violence curtailing. I also think it is a time where communities are going to have to come together and start not necessarily their own street justice, but certainly protecting their communities and showing that there is a concern or consideration of their neighbors, instead of living in the silos that I think many of us in the city have done for so long, that as long as mine is protected, that's all we were concerned about. But the reality is, we are all connected in these communities. And until we start to think about ourselves as a viable community, I think we're going to continue to see this level of violence increase.
James DeGraffenwright, Catherine Pugh comes to her office from the state legislature as a senator, has putatively a very good relationship with the governor. I mean, as good as it can be, perhaps, given that she's a Democrat, he's a Republican. But do you see opportunities here for the state to be more involved and more effectively involved in addressing some of the city's really difficult problems, given the governor's stance on several issues that have directly affected Baltimore in just these last few months?
I think the opportunity is there. Whether the potential is there is a different question. You know, the red line decision, the state office building decision, some other things that have happened indicate that the governor has made all the right words come out of his mouth in terms of support for Baltimore City, but one by one, the executive actions he's taken contradict that. I've known Mayor Pugh for a long time, and I know she knows what to ask for and probably has already asked for things that will make things better in the city. But what the governor will do is another question. Small example of that is, you know, let's step away from the violence question and just talk about the air conditioning spat with Baltimore County. Mm-hmm. You know, traditionally, you mentioned that the governor's a Republican, Mayor Pugh is a Democrat. Well, Republicans traditionally have stood for the proposition that they support local control and don't like to have top-down management. But what did
and
we
here's
get?
The governor running the HVAC but systems with for Kevin Kamenetz.
Well, yeah. but think about what just happened, right? We had this great press release display, this public display, calling everybody on the carpet for not putting window shakers in. When any building mechanical engineer will tell you that an HVAC system consists of a whole bunch of things that have to work together, including shell measures, and that there are professionals in state government who had a program to address all of that, but they beat, you know, the county executive and the superintendent about the head and shoulders, figuratively. And what
with
happened?
With the aid of Peter Francho, the Democratic comptroller of the state.
But look at what just happened with the Begathon, right? They are now funding the same things that they beat him up for saying was the right way to go in the first place.
And the biggest one is when the education leaders come before the Board of Estimates and make their case.
Yeah, in spite of the fact that what the officials from Baltimore City and County told them this week was basically the same thing they told them last year.
That's right.
Exactly. So there's a lot of, I think, PR management going on, but not a whole lot of working together. Yeah.
So back to the issue of what the state can do in terms of helping the city with the crime, there are some direct kind of tactical things in terms of coordinating between parole and probation and the city police and some other things like that that were done during the O'Malley years when Governor O'Malley was in office that fell by the wayside toward the end of his term during the Rawlings-Blake administration that could be revived. But, you know, we also have to remember that Governor O'Malley was exceptionally focused and interested in this particular issue. And, you know, Larry Hogan is just not to the same degree.
410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're talking local, statewide, national, and international politics and news events of the week. Let's go to the phones. Clarence from New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for your platform. You have such great things going on today, but I'm going to comment on the elections.
Okie doke, what's on your mind?
The media has a part in what has happened in this country. Basically, the man that's in the office, he would call different shows in the morning, he would comment, and the media had a lot of information that they could have looked at, but they didn't. So now it's a war between the media and him. And what needs to happen with the media, be it printed or over the airways with television or cable or whatever. My mom had 13 children, and we were taught as little kids, when you were like 3 to 4, 3 to 5, you told stories. After that, you told lies. So you cannot justify this man when he says it's things like last week when he was inaugurated arguing about the crowds. He lied.
But Clarence, you think that there's a lot of information that the people in the media have about Mr. Trump that has not been reported? Do you think people are holding back? Do I understand you correctly when you make that assertion?
Well, when the information came out with the tape of what he had said, when the information came out, half of the public did not know about what went on with the Central Park Five. I'm 68 years old. I read the paper. I look at the news. I try to look at stuff in a different way. Publications, just like in Baltimore. The Sun papers, when you have a newspaper and you have journalists, they're supposed to be looking at it in a professional way. No matter what their belief is, they're supposed to give the public the truth, whether they like it or not. And that's not where we're getting today.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Clarence. I appreciate it. Before we ask our panel to respond, here's Mr. Trump speaking at the CIA last week, describing his feelings about his relationship to the media.
I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth. What? And they sort of made it sound like I had a feud with the intelligence community. And I just want to let you know, the reason you're number one stop, it is exactly the opposite.
So, Andy Green, right. There's a lot packed in there.
Yeah.
One of which is the sustained applause that he received.
Yeah.
And maybe that was from CIA professionals, or maybe that was from Trump staffers.
Apparently he did pack the room with some of his own staffers. And also, of course, it was at the CIA on a Saturday. So it's, you know, the people who chose to come in.
Crowd.
Maybe do not represent the entire intelligence community. Nonetheless, you know, as a member of the apparently the most dishonest profession in the world, all I can say is takes one to know one, apparently. You know, getting to the caller's point, you know, I think the media has been pretty dogged in calling out lies when they hear them from the president so far. That if you read the Times, you read the Post, you read, you know, the coverage we have of it in the Sun, you will not see people saying, well, the president says this and other people say that. You will hear, you know, see them saying that when he says 3 to 5 million people voted illegally, that that is untrue. You know, there's been
quite famously,
a lot
the
less
New York Times had a headline yesterday that included the word lies describing this. Yeah. James DeGraffenreit, Steve Bannon, a senior advisor to the president, said yesterday to, of all people, the New York Times, whom he called to offer an interview, that the media should keep its mouth shut and listen. He was asked whether or not Sean Spicer was going to suffer some discredit with the media because of assertions he made on his very first day about the size of the inaugural crowd and voter fraud, et cetera. And Bannon basically said the more discredited Sean Spicer or anybody appears to be with the media, the better it is for us, because it was people who believe the media to be absolutely not credible, that were more than happy to elect Trump because he was a, you know, quote unquote, tell it like it is kind of guy. How does this end, you know?
Steve Bannon is Mr. Breitbart, and he's Mr. Alt-Right. I think we have to give credit where credit is due. They know their audience, and that's who they're talking to. If you get away from blue states or blue oases in the red desert, you know, the cities, the coasts, and you actually go places like I do to Indiana or talk to people out in Kansas and New Mexico and places like that, I mean, that's their base. And those people get a steady diet, an unrelenting diet of when they watch TV, they're watching Fox. And they're not watching news on Fox. They're watching the people who tell you they're not journalists, like Sean Hannity. And they're getting the messages that way. Or they're sitting out, you know, this is very rural country where this base comes from, the rural counties around the country. So you have people out there on a tractor or on some kind of Caterpillar equipment listening to talk radio all day. And that's all they know. These are decent people. They think they're informed, but that's their source. And that's really what Steve Bannon is saying, you know.
And Kimberly Moffitt, you're a media specialist. Is it coincidental that the rise of the alt-right media, places like Breitbart, came to be at a time when many media organizations like Andy's newspaper and newspapers across the country are facing severe financial pressures and they're cutting back. Now, Jeff Bezos has just announced an addition of 80 people to the newsroom of the Washington Post. Where the credibility of the media with a certain part of the electorate, a large part of which voted for Mr. Trump, is at an all-time low.
Yeah, and what I find most fascinating about this particular area is social media give us so much access to a plethora of news, and yet what we have done as news individuals taking in information is to build those silos even stronger and to remain in echo chambers, just talking to like-minded individuals instead of actually hearing what others are saying. And so as a media critic, one of the things that I do is I'm always watching multiple news outlets. And so at Trump's press briefing at the CIA this weekend, I sat watching CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, all to hear how these different news agencies were talking about the same issue and what angles were they taking on. And instead of being informed like that, what many of us are choosing to do is align ourselves with who already says what we want to say.
Yeah. And of course, you know, on any given day, if somebody calls me dishonest, that's probably a pretty good day. I mean, if that's the worst thing I'm called on any given day, that's I'm okay with that. Before we take a break, Alexia from Frederick, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was very excited to hear that you guys were on because I have just recently heard about the legislative aid from Maryland. I'm from Frederick County. I live in Frederick within the city limits. And I recently read the articles about David Voigt III's legislative aide, who admitted apparently to the New York Times that he was behind the ChristianTimesNewspaper.com, which was a fake news site.
He was a fake newser, indeed, right here in Maryland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to find more news about it in our local paper and feel shocked that there's not more outrage about it locally.
Well, the Sun did do a piece about this, Andy Green.
I'll call my friends at the News Post and see if they can get on it. But so the story is this was a guy who had just recently graduated from college and was working as a legislative aide here in Maryland. And on the side, he started writing fake news posts on this website that you mentioned about related to things that Donald Trump was saying on the campaign trail. So his biggest piece was about alleging that there were, you know, millions of pre-filled out Hillary Clinton ballots in a warehouse in Ohio. And he's just making this stuff up.
He's doctored a picture and everything.
A clip art image from somewhere on the internet, slapping it up, and got all of these hits because it would get shared around on social media among people who didn't take a particularly critical view of it. He made a ton of money from this, from Google Ads. Google is supposedly trying to clamp down on this. But, you know, according to him, what he told the Times was he wasn't doing it so much for political reasons as financial ones. You know, he had student loans to pay off and everything. He's claimed to the Times he would have been perfectly happy to write fake news for Hillary Clinton's side, but that didn't get the clicks.
And of course, you know, Mr. Trump himself has suggested that it could be some 400-pound guy in New Jersey doing this. Perhaps it's some 14-year-old in Macedonia. This is an example of a 23-year-old right here in Maryland.
Anyway, the point is that when the story broke, he was fired immediately. So.
Yeah. Scott Shane wrote about it in the New York Times, and he lost his job the next day. All right, we're going to take a little break. It's the Midday News Wrap. Kimberly Moffitt from UMBC, Andy Green from the Baltimore Sun, and James DeGraffenreit, a former chair of the Maryland State Board of Education, join us. You can join us as well, 410-662-8780, midday@wypr.org is our email address and our Twitter handle @midday. Tom Hall, stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. It's the Midday News Wrap on this Friday afternoon. James DeGraffenreit is with us. He's a businessman and lawyer. He's the past chairman of the State Board of Education and the former chairman and chief executive officer of WGL Holdings. That's the parent company of Washington Gas. Andy Green is the opinions editor for the Baltimore Sun. He writes about state and local government, social issues, and elections. Kimberly Moffitt is a media critic and associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. You are a big part of our conversation. 410-662-8780 is the number to call. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. Let me read a couple of emails. This is from Michelle, who says, I totally disagree with your guess that Congress should vote for whomever Trump selects to serve in his cabinet, because that is the traditional way it has always been done in the past. That sentiment does not work in these times. No, nothing Trump has done has been what has been traditionally done. So why should Congress be bound by rules if the president himself doesn't respect them? Thank you for that comment, Michelle. Here's another question or comment from TS, who says he has a question, he or she has a question about White House office websites. What happens to the content of those pages once they've been erased, besides them being archived? We're not even sure if they are archived.
I mean, I'm sure Google has them.
Yeah. What about the work that still needs to be done in the area specifically regarding the Office of National AIDS Policy? HIV/AIDS is a nonpartisan issue, and there's a rumor circulating and fear among consumers and advocates for HIV services that the Office of National AIDS Policy has been dissolved. Anybody know anything about that?
I don't know about that.
I haven't heard that, but I also would say AIDS is not considered a nonpartisan issue.
I mean, although President Bush was pretty good on that, not maybe perfect, but pretty good.
Yep.
I mean, we did see the reinstatement of the gag rule regarding family planning funds abroad, that basically they, federal money does not pay for abortions abroad, never has, nor does it domestically. But under Republican presidents, typically the aid has been prohibited from going to organizations that even will talk to you about abortion. And so the result of that has been, in times when this policy has been in effect, there has been an increase in AIDS and an increase in abortions, actually, in countries that were heavy recipients of this aid.
And we should say that these executive orders, executive actions, many of them really are purely symbolic. Mm-hmm. For example, Mr. Trump made a big deal about getting us out of TPP with the signature on a magic piece of paper. We were never in the TPP. So this was, you know, backing up a pledge that he made, or an opinion he had on that thing. Opinion happened to be shared by Hillary Clinton eventually, and certainly Bernie Sanders and several in Congress. It's interesting that the Republicans now have done a 180 on trade. That they used to be the folks that were very much in support of free trade agreements like NAFTA, like TPP, and now they are falling in line behind their Republican president.
It's strange to me, frankly. as you say, the Republican Party is known as the free trade party. And promoters of it. So for them to do the 180, I think, says everything about where we are in terms of how people get elected to the United States Congress. The seats are relatively safe for a given party because of gerrymandering. And the biggest fear they have is being, they've turned the word into a verb, primaried. So they don't dare go against somebody that is perceived to have a lot of support in their home districts. So I think that explains, you know, that as long as they get what they want politically, they're going to go along with Trump on what he wants until they don't.
Right. Let's try to head back to the phones. Jill in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. You, I guess, want to talk about a story that was in the Sun today about CEO of the Baltimore City Schools, Dr. Sonia Sonalesis, and some of her difficult decisions. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Hi, James. She announced today that she anticipated there would need to be cuts of up to 1,000 staff, and it would include teachers, would likely include arts programs across the board. As she put it, all the reasons kids like to come to school. And so we need to lobby to get additional funding for schools in Baltimore City. You were speaking earlier about problems of public safety. Things that keep kids in school are the arts and other programs. It's not easy to get teachers to come to Baltimore City schools. Announcements like this have teachers start to look elsewhere for positions. So we need to, as a community, get on this as soon as possible. Everyone who's not already working in this direction, and get the funding that the Thornton Amendment guaranteed that we should have.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Jill. I appreciate it. And Andy Green, Luke Broadwater had a piece in your paper a few days ago about the sort of strangeness that there is this big deficit in schools. I mean, Governor Hogan is cutting a lot of funds that were earmarked for Baltimore because we have these casinos.
Mm. Yeah.
And they're generating all sorts of money. How come it's not going to the schools?
Yeah, I mean, we wrote an editorial about that basically stretched out to 700 words the phrase, "We told you so," that no one ever said that this would result in more money going to the schools. People who believed that when they voted for it were seriously misinformed. All it has done is allowed the state to reduce the money that it otherwise would have put into the school system. It did not change the school funding formulas. It is not bonus money for the schools. It is basically just going into a pot of money and is not helping the schools any more than they would have been helped otherwise.
So then is this simply a matter of politicians saying stuff that isn't true, you're reporting at the time that it may or may not or probably isn't true, and people just believing the politicians instead of what they read.
When the last gambling expansion was on the ballot, I wrote like 100 editorials explaining to people that but nobody cares because, you know, we're not, unlike the casino, spending $40 million to put ads on TV.
And that's what it comes down to, is the marketing campaign. And those who were backing the casinos were more convincing to voters than the sensible folks at The Sun and other papers who were saying, this is not what our funds are being used for. And also, it's unfortunate because history shows us that that is never what casinos or lotteries do. Although, I mean, even in the state of North Carolina, it refers to itself as the North Carolina Education Lottery. But yet we see the same results in terms of whether or not funds are trickling down to the school systems. But they are very effective in convincing us that they are.
Just got a couple minutes left, and I want to talk about a campaign that wasn't meant to be a campaign, but a person who ended up being incredibly influential to journalists. And that is Mary Tyler Moore, who, when she had her show, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and she played an associate producer at a television station in Minneapolis. Since her death at the age of 80 a few days ago, many journalists, particularly women, have said, I watch Mary Tyler Moore and I wanted to be her. She, as a media figure, Kimberly Moffitt, she was quite influential.
Yes, she was. She was. I was a wee child when her show was on, but I will say, as a child, I did feel inspired by seeing her presence, and just her at the end of her intro of the show throwing up her hat was one of those things that made you feel like women can have it all. And so she is. She was one of those forces in television as a whole, that gave us a sense that this was possible, whatever it was that you wanted to do. And I think she did a fabulous job of doing so.
James DeGravenwright, it's really fascinating how an L.A. law came out. Everybody started going to law school. You know? and Mary Tyler Moore really was a transformative figure. She was on the air from 1970 to 1977, the end of the civil rights era, Dr. King and his movement, and the beginning of the so-called women's lib movement, that we used to refer to it as that back in the day. Media does play a huge role, and Ms. Moore was such a gifted actor and such a gifted comedienne that she connected with people in a real visceral way. I wonder, is that a lesson? You know, we've just had this women's marches all around the country and all around the world just last week. Are there lessons to be learned about getting the message of those who oppose the current president out to the people at large?
Well, you know, one point that I want to make about Mary Tyler Moore that I heard yesterday on this station, I forget who said it, but what was really unique about her as a female comedy actor was that she was funny in the role because she was good at her job. So she was managing all the dysfunction of the men in the office around her. And that was new, as contrasted with Lucille Ball, who was funny because she was bad at her job. You know.
And yeah, that's fascinating.
That was kind of a very insightful comment that was made. But to your question, yes, I think that films like Hidden Figures, you know, all of that, you know.
Yeah. Great movie. And it just
changes people's perspective on how to think about this.
All right. Well, thanks to all of you. I appreciate it. We shall have you back for this at some other time. Appreciate it. Kimberly Moffitt is a media critic and associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Andy Green is the editorial director of the opinions page at the Baltimore Sun. James DeGraffenwright is a businessman and a lawyer. That'll do it for this edition of the Midday News Wrap. Coming up Monday on Midday, giving a second chance to people who have been served failure to appear warrants. Doug Colbert of the Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland joins us, along with Rachel Bay. She's WIPR's Statehouse reporter, to talk about criminal justice issues that are being addressed in this year's General Assembly. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show's produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.
You can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile. Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show, love is all